Hello, everyone, and welcome to the HCI-1 Proposed Rule Task Force. I'd like to welcome everybody, and we do have a guest discussant with us today. And I'd also like to welcome Alex Contour from ONC, who will be providing an overview of the RFIs up for discussion. All of our task force meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is welcome, which can be typed in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting, or could be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled toward the end of the meeting. I'd like to begin roll call of our task force members. When I call your name, please indicate if you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs and group three lead, Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Hung Lu.
Good morning.
Hans Lutendeck.
Good morning.
Tom McDonald. Maurice Thunder-Bajan. And Phil Sutherland.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone, and please join me in welcoming Stephen Lane, Steve Eichner, and Hung Lu for their opening remarks.
You wanna take it away, Hung?
Sure. Thanks, Mike, and welcome again to another session of the Group 3 Task Force. We are in the final leg of our journey, and I'm really excited to have some presenters who will be helping provide some information to guide us on our fulfillment of the charge. And also, as always, we welcome a public comment either through the chat or verbally at the during the public comment session. Stephen, all right, do you have anything to add?
No, you're doing great.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. As always, I think next we will briefly go over the charge. So I think the pertinent one to today is on the next slide, which is the RFI on program standards, certification criteria, and information blocking to form potential future rulemaking. And so today's session is mainly on the requests of information on the fire subscriptions, fire standard for scheduling, and smart health links request for information. And so at this time, I'd like to turn it over to our first speaker, Alex Contour from the ONC.
Hi, can you hear me all right?
Yes.
All right, great. I will jump in then. If you can go to the next slide, please. And then you can go one more. All right, thanks. So again, my name is Alex Contour. Appreciate you all having me on today to come and speak about the three remaining fire-related requests for information in HTI-1. As we've already mentioned, I'm going to be talking about three of these RFIs, one on fire subscriptions, one on smart scheduling links, and one on smart health links. For each one of these, I've got a bit of background just to introduce the underlying standards, and then we'll do a quick overview of the request for comment itself. So getting started with fire subscriptions. Fire subscriptions is actually a framework that's defined in the base fire specification. It's not like a separate implementation guide or anything like that. The basic concept here is to enable fire servers to send event notifications to other systems. So rather than kind of following the query response paradigm where you have a system that's constantly asking a fire server for updates to information that it cares about, the server can actually send proactively notifications when certain content is changed. So fire subscriptions uses a couple of different resources for processing and sending these notifications. The first one to call attention to is the subscription topic resource, which is really a server's way of advertising the types of subscriptions that it makes available to clients. Each subscription topic is going to define things like the trigger that will actually trigger the sending of a notification from the server. So for example, that might be like the creation of a patient resource or some system level event like a patient being admitted. And then it also has some information about how clients can filter those notifications so that they only receive the data that they care about. The subscription resource itself represents the client's actual request to be notified based on a subscription topic that's been advertised by the server. So really it's the thing that the client signs up for and information about what that subscription looks like. So the subscription resource is going to carry things like what filters the client wants to apply to its subscription, its notifications. So for example, if it only wants encounters of a certain type as opposed to all encounters, it has information about the communication channel that the client prefers to receive notifications through. And it also has some information about what kind of content the client wants to receive in the body of the notifications. And the subscriptions framework actually defines three basic types of content for these notifications. There's this concept of like a ping only or an empty notification, which has virtually no content. This is important because there's going to be no PHI that's actually carried in the message. So it's a little bit more privacy preserving. But the client then has to go out to the server and query for additional information to figure out what actually triggered the subscription and get information back on those resources. It's somewhere in the middle is this ID only type of notification, which has a limited set of content, the identifier for the resources that triggered the subscription. And the notification provides a URL so that the client can go back and query to fetch additional information on those resources. And then finally, there's the notifications that include everything, right? The full content of the resources that triggered the notification. And so the client doesn't have to go back and actually query for that information. It has it right there in the notification bundle. So notifications do come as a bundle resource. They also include what's called a subscription status resource. And that resource provides some additional metadata and context about the notification. The last thing I wanted to note on this slide is that the subscriptions framework changed significantly between FHIR Release 4 and FHIR Release 5. Many of the concepts that I just talked about, like subscription topics, didn't exist at all in FHIR R4. But there was work in an interim release of FHIR, FHIR R4B, which included a methodology for mapping between the different approaches. And then, of course, FHIR R5 has the full subscriptions framework as we know it today. So on the next slide, please. Just with all of that in mind, a quick summary. FHIR subscriptions provide the ability for a FHIR server to proactively notify a client or other system when new information has been added or existing information has been updated. These subscriptions can help reduce server load by reducing redundant queries, and they can also help automate certain system workflows. So in HTI1, we request comment on a few things, one being the maturity of subscription-related resources in the FHIR R4 standard, and then whether alignment with the FHIR R5 standard would help avoid costly refactoring of these resources and or help give more time to the industry to test the various features and capabilities under development. Whether we should define a minimum set of subscription topics so that there's a consistent implementation instead of expected behaviors for clients to build around. And then finally, any other considerations related to security, the communications channels by which clients can receive notifications, notification payloads, or anything else that might be might require additional specification in the subscription framework or a subsequent implementation guide. So I think the plan is to pause after each one of these to allow for discussion. So I think that's what I'll do, or I can just jump right into the next one if that's preferred.
Let's keep going, Alex, and then after you're done with all three, you and Brett can answer questions of the task force.
All right, sounds good. If you can go to the next slide, then we'll start on smart scheduling links. So the next RFI that we wanted to discuss today is smart scheduling links. This standard is aimed at a relatively narrow use case, which is enabling the discovery and booking of appointments. one of the ways that you can kind of think about this is the way that we use travel aggregators to be able to book flights from the airlines to sort of compare the types of flights that are available. The basic workflow here starts when a client queries an appointment service known as a slot publisher by the lingo of the standard to discover some basic information about which appointment slots are available. The standard supports some basic search capabilities, you know, things like filtering appointments by geography, specialty, you know, which health system is providing them, that sort of thing. Once a client finds an appointment slot that works for the user, it can follow a link from that slot to the provider's booking portal, and that will enable the user to actually book the appointment. In the process of booking the appointment, the booking portal might ask the user to supply some additional information, but the scope of this information and the content of this information is really out of scope for the scheduling link standard itself. Looking under the hood at some of the technical components here, really there's the slot publisher or appointment service publishes a series of JSON files. These include an overall manifest of all of the information related to appointments and appointment slots. And the client can use that to sort of iterate through and discover appropriate appointments. There are also location files, which describe the physical locations at which these appointments are available. There are schedule files, which help map specific services to appointment slots that are available at locations. And then finally, there's the slot files themselves, which provide the discrete data about the available appointment slots. These slots can be pretty specific, something like, you know, an appointment at 2 o'clock p.m. on a such and such day, or they can be more coarse grained, such as, you know, an appointment but somewhere between 9 to 5 p.m. Next slide. So just to recap here, smart scheduling links enable providers to advertise things like available vaccine appointments using a lightweight, scalable API, and then also enable clients to go in and book appointments. In HTI1, we do request feedback on a few things, including the maturity and scope of the smart scheduling links implementation guide. The comments on the guidance from the implementation guide about how publishers can advertise API endpoints and whether there are any other approaches that we ONC could take to ensure the discoverability of APIs, whether there's any other appropriate scheduling related activities to consider led by the industry as potential models or approaches for this. For example, we know that there's an Argonaut scheduling implementation guide out there. How to best ensure the accuracy and timeliness of appointment information when it's made available. And then finally, how to support the scalability of the standard for use in a variety of different healthcare settings. All right, next slide, please. So the last RFI to cover today is Smart Health Links. And you might already be familiar with the concept of smart health cards, and I'm going to be talking about both of them here because they're conceptually very similar. Basically, the idea behind both of these standards is to enable users to take a limited set of information to make that information portable so that it can be stored or presented by the user at a later time for whatever purposes that they need. So a really common example of this to help kind of wrap your mind around it. It has to do with vaccination records, right? Especially when we're talking about, you know, providing or demonstrating proof that an individual has received a COVID vaccine. Basically, what can happen is that smart cards enable the vaccination site to take a digital record of the patient's vaccine. You can encode it as a QR code and then provide that QR code back to the patient, whether on paper or digitally, so that the patient can then go and take that QR code and share it freely with other parties, whether that's like a mobile health application or some other entity that needs to verify that the patient has received a COVID vaccine. There are some drawbacks to the smart health cards model because we typically associate these health cards with QR codes There are some size limitations inherent to the QR code standard that we need to worry about. And so if we've got like, a larger set of data or a more extensive set of vaccination records, for example, it can be hard to kind of fit all of those into a single QR code and make that available. Likewise, we tend to think of health cards as more static in nature, that the data isn't necessarily expected to change over time. But to address some of the limitations of the health cards model and the sort of QR code approach, and just to offer a little bit more flexibility to implementers, Smart Health Links builds on top of the Smart Health Cards framework. I'm not going to get too deep into the technical details of each of these standards because they're fairly complex not terribly pertinent to what we're talking about today. But I did want to drive home some of the vision behind both Health Links and Health Cards. And that's really to put more control into the hands of consumers or patients in terms of what information they want to share and then how they can actually share that information. So by turning FHIR resources into these cards or making them sort of links that are otherwise accessible, the consumer can more readily share specific sets of information for specific use cases, however they please. And that's by doing things like, opening a link to that information in a browser or otherwise integrating it with a mobile application. One thing to note also is that these are both framework standards, again, so they don't, specifically detail any use cases that are required for implementers to follow. And next slide. So just to summarize here, Smart Health Links uses a very similar approach as that used by Smart Health Cards to provide individuals with deeper control over with whom and how they share their health information. Smart Health Links itself is designed to overcome some of the limitations of the Smart Cards paradigm and to enable even more robust sharing of information. So therefore, with all that in mind, we do request feedback on the value and feasibility of the Smart Health Link standard, any concerns regarding its implementation, approaches that ONC could take to encourage the rapid advancement and implementation of Smart Health Links, and then finally, any other promising industry-led activities that we should consider that are aligned with the FHIR standard and can help improve interoperability using Health IT. So that's my overview of these three RFIs, and happy to turn it over to Brett for any additional remarks or discussion from the work group.
Ike, you have your hand up?
Yes, I do. This is, I guess, both a question and an observation. One of the issues around smart card utilization, and this is not necessarily strictly a technical issue, it's a usage issue, is discrimination based on the application of smart card components. For example, looking at a smart card that happens to contain vaccination information may not include information about an individual's disability, pushing the person with a disability into separate manual screening and denying them timely access to the same venues. Again, that's not a technical issue with the technology, but it is an implementation challenge. And I'm wondering, is there something in our proposed regulation that helps address that and kind of cuts that off or that up those implementation issues off of the knees? Because it is a real issue in looking at discrimination. And it may be something that we want to bounce to the annual report group, but I think it is a related issue.
This is Lon, so I'm just curious. Part of the capabilities would agreed is that you would not have necessarily all data available based on what's actually agreed to be on the card. But there is opportunity, not that that is currently necessarily done, but that there could be enough information on it as well to get more information to query for that. So would it be a suggestion to look at that implementation guidance around the use of this? Is that where not necessarily all data can be included, to consider that there's opportunity to go back to the source to get potentially more? But even then, the source of the card that provided information may not have that information either. So it's a larger challenge of how much can you put on and where do you know to query to get more information if it's not on, but you need it.
Right. As I said, the issue, I don't think, is a purely technical issue. Certainly not about providing the data. The issue is looking at how the smart card or how the smart link is actually being used in practice, so that you're not creating an additional burden for folks where a decision is being made based on the content of the smart link or the smart card and putting an unnecessary burden on a subset of the population. Again, it's not a technology challenge, it's a usage challenge.
Stephen?
Is there an inherent technical limitation in the quantity of data that can be tucked behind the QR code? Brett, you're shaking your head, yes.
Yeah, there is. And that, I think that's where the transition, I can't remember where the cutoff is, but it's kind of a fun project actually with smart health cards. The barcode, as they get denser and denser and denser, it actually gets harder for people to even scan them. And so if you see like an ad on the front of a store, they typically have big, big blocks. But as you pack more information, they get tighter. And there's actually a limit. I don't remember how many immunizations it was when we were testing it, but it wasn't very many. I can get you the exact number before the call's over. And so no, you couldn't embed a CCD or full 3 years of data unless there was a very healthy patient. And so that's where Smart Health Links was born, to be able to kind of reach back and download a specific set of information.
I got it. So the card itself, Brett, actually contains the data, in this case, the immunization data, whereas the link sends you back to the source.
You got it.
It wouldn't necessarily send you back to the source. It could also send you to like a static web page where the information is hosted. So there's it's a lot of flexibility kind of inherent in the standard. There, you can have a more tight integration to like an API, so you can go pull the full set of data back from the source, or it can go to some other, you know, statically hosted point. Sort of like when you go to restaurants these days and they give you the QR code for a menu. The QR code doesn't usually fit the full menu. It's just sort of a link to their website often where you can go and view the menu.
Yeah, we do need to keep in mind that with these contexts, that the source being referenced, depending on what kind of source you're trying to get to, may not have the data that you're interested in either, based on the nature of the kind of data of interest in the healthcare context. So it's in that regard, we always have to be a little bit aware that yes, we can link back. We can link back to a source, maybe multiple sources, but no guarantee that they have everything either.
So let me, right, Hans is right. So let me just talk about like what I know about Smart Health Links, where I see it going, and then something for folks to think about. So Smart Health Links grew out of the idea of wanting to include more than just the COVID vaccines in the card and more information. And in the kind of current state of industry today, there is work, there's a group that has done some pilot work in the international patient summary, where the kind of a traveler is, you know, moving across borders and wants to be able to share a summary of their record with a new provider. And so there's actually pilot testing at the May Connectathon, where someone is actually able to have a smart health link, which then would link out to a server to download that information. And, you know, that has some potential in the US market. I think the part where I get very excited about smart health links, and there has also been some pilot work around this, is around immunizations. There's a few state registries who've experimented with enabling smart health links to immunization records. And so when I think about smart health links, the opportunity of what they can do is, it's huge. And the idea of here's the patient is kind of helping mediate the, hey, here's where my record is. But of course there's all kinds of complexities of like, what are they, you know, if you send, you know, a whole health history or what, you know, what's going to be included at the smart health link location. And so for me, when I think about like, what could we actually do with smart links today, smart health links, I think the idea of like immunization summaries from providers, you know, immunization manifest would be enormously helpful. I think about like, you know, page, you know, for those of us with small children signing up for schools and camps and trying to get immunization records to those people, it's not a small feat. And the idea that you would be able to share a QR code that then that particular school nurse could then download that information would be an incredible benefit to the community.
Except Brett, and sorry, that's exactly the problem, is that I happen to have a disability that limits my ability to be immunized. And unless that immunization information contains information about my exemptions, that's legal, then when I go to present the information, you look at it and say, oh, you're not immunized, you can't come in our front door, even though I may have a perfectly valid and legal exemption. But that's not reflected in that record. So now you're putting a burden on me to have to go through a different process to provide this exemption information. And again, this is not a technical issue,
but the
application of the technology is putting a huge unbalanced burden on a separate set of, individuals.
And my response is it's a really important thing that the technology needs to accommodate. And my kind of like three quick responses is like, I don't necessarily immediately think it could be more burden. Like maybe there's a smart health card that gets issued to folks who are, you know, aren't able to get immunized. So it's all embedded right there. And there's no kind of smart health link. And that's just something you display in that workflow. Or maybe in the smart health link callback, when you get that payload, in that payload, there's a kind of signed indicator that you're not able to get that. Or maybe it's the third of like
As I said, it's not a technical issue, it's an implementation issue. But and the standards here are looking strictly at the technical implementation. I'm suggesting that in conjunction with the technical guidelines, there need to be guardrails in place so that you cannot use the technology to actually create a framework that is discriminatory.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's totally understand. And that's reasonable. Yeah.
Just a comment on that, because I think this is actually a very good example that this example applies to health links, and you go to CDS hooks, you go to subscriptions, go to the couple of other ones. We have to be very cautious considering suggesting certifying to these kind of quote unquote base standards. They provide a key capability, whether subscriptions, health links, CDS hooks, but not until you have the context well-defined and can address issues like this as well on how to do that, what is expected minimally, what to include. A consideration of certification is hard. It's along the lines of certifying against HL7 version 2 or against FHIR version 3 CDA or HL7 CDA or against HL7 FHIR R4. We can all do it in 10 different ways, 100 different ways, using the same constructs, similar constructs, slightly differently for the same use case. And in examples like this, we might miss something. So I think generally is that a lot of these fundamental capabilities are starting to be mature technologically, but do we have sufficient implementation guidance? Depending on the use case, different needs for that that are sufficiently ready. And is that really what's supposed to be the focus of certification, so that we consistently implement that and that we therefore can communicate with anybody seamlessly? Just pointing to these kind of base standards, I don't think does it. And that doesn't mean that they're not mature enough. They are quite well along to be able to do that and provide that context, but that needs to be built out to make sure that we do that and don't run into these kind of challenges either unnecessarily and grow into that. So generally, feedback that I would suggest is that standards sufficiently mature to start to really work with it, clear, but build the implementation guide, focus on that, on a number of use cases for each one of these, where then it is, where it would make sense to consider certification, because we want to have consistent adoption, wide adoption, easily scalable, et cetera, to get it interoperability without special effort. So otherwise it's going to be very special effort every time around.
Well, and Hans, I would like to thank you for saying it in a much more eloquent way than I did. I think I'd like to add one more phrase: and be used without special effort.
Fair. Completely agreed.
Yeah. Oh, this is Phil. I was wondering, maybe this was a segue as we're talking about use cases. There was a comment with from Mark in the chat about the fast shared care planning use case. And I was wondering if how this would interplay with some of the fast initiatives, as you know, and maybe getting a little more information on your comment there, Mark. And I don't know if
Mark's a member of the public, Phil, so he can't speak until the public comment period.
Okay, maybe we can wait until that point then.
So I was going to add on a little bit to Hans's comment about kind of baseline functionality. I listened to the CDS Hooks chat last week. I thought it was very good. I think what's interesting about certifying kind of base functionality is there's an assumption that when everyone reads that base, like subscriptions is a great example actually of like, I'll be able to subscribe to my care team updates, ADT events. I'll be subscribed to public health case reporting, you know, or specific conditions. I'll be able to subscribe to all these things. And so if you kind of create the certification criterion that is just kind of wide open, different EHR vendors approach it slightly differently. And then every reader thinks it solves their problem. But in the end, you've sort of enabled this functionality, but it's not enough for us all to grab and kind of coalesce around a use case. And so for each of, you know, subscriptions, smart health links, CDS hooks, I think it's incredibly important to be, you know, it's great to specify, you know, support the base standard, but then to be very specific in one area. So then we at least know everyone's rowing in the same direction on that piece. And then over time, you can expand what people do.
And to amplify that further is that if, as we do in a number of cases, we are pointing in an implementation guide to one or more underlying technical specifications. And that's therefore agreement on how to interpret in that context that underlying specification. You really don't need to then point to the underlying specification as a separate certification requirement anymore, because the only way in which you can test and adhere to the implementation guide is that you correctly and consistently interpreted the underlying standard. Yes, some certification requirements have, you need to support version 2.5 whatever, and then the LRI or the ELR implementation guide. That's all good in a way, but ELR is sufficient. It will pull in what it needs. And once you do that, you start to get a lot more consistent in the way that you're applying the standard to begin with. So it's typically much more important to focus on the implementation guide to get this done as standard. We've seen all the varieties of version 2. We're seeing all the varieties of FHIR. We're seeing all the varieties of CDA. That's what happens if you point to the underlying standard.
Hong, you got your own hand up. You got the chair's prerogative.
Yes. So I was actually very intrigued by the FHIR subscription because of the fact that is this intended only towards patient information, or is there more flexibility in its application? Because I can definitely see it dovetailing with some of what the SHIELD initiative is trying to accomplish. I'll lay out some background. So what the strategy for SHIELD is that there would be a central repository of curated standard codes for basically every test that has been approved by the FDA. And so the thinking is that by having these codes pre-curated, we can decrease the burden on laboratories to and have a authoritative source of truth, so that it would be easier for laboratories to go and look up the source of truth in terms of the correct coding for their test based on the manufacturer, but also have a way to pull that information maybe by API down and be able to encode their local menu with the curated codes. One of the issues is, of course, standards never stay static, and there may be changes that are made to the code necessitated by evolving standards. And so one of the things that is really exciting about your description is the ability to subscribe and be able to be informed of any changes in the codes that have occurred, and to pull down those specific changes rather than having to download everything each time. Is that a possibility with this, or is this more intended towards patient information?
No, that's a great use case. I mean, we tend to, a lot of use cases within the HLM community talk about patients as the primary target, but you're right. I mean, the way it's designed is it's to support kind of subscribing to any kind of FHIR resource change. And so a topic could be defined to do what you described.
So my understanding is that our goal here as a work group is to see if we want to provide any specific input regarding the readiness, suitability, utility of any of these three FHIR tools. Hans, I've heard you that we may not be ready as an industry to really see broad adoption of the smart health links. But these other two, the subscriptions and the scheduling links, certainly seem very appealing, you know, and could provide a lot of value if they were broadly available across certified health IT. I'm really interested, Brett, you know, in your sense as our invited expert. I mean, do you feel that these first two are ready, are sufficiently mature to be considered by ONC for a future round of updates to the certification criteria?
And just to make sure, the two subscriptions and scheduling were the two you zoomed in.
Yeah. I just wanted to sort of start with subscriptions.
Okay.
One at a time, right?
Yeah. I mean, so subscriptions, it's, you know, I looked back through my notes to remember, you know, so the Argonaut community ran a subscription kind of project, I think, two or three years back, and was part of the, you know, refinement of the design. And so there was targeted input. There's been several connectathons. I think the idea of this committee recommending subscriptions proceed is a good idea. And I'm a little bit careful my wording here is that because we have this kind of interesting situation at HL7 in that there's kind of this R4 approach, there's kind of this R5 approach, there's kind of this R4B approach. I have my own opinion, which I think is, but I think it'd be wise to direct the industry on a specific topic and decide which version they think is best. And I know that's a little loose, Stephen, but I rewind back to like 2015 when the Cures rule came out and ONC said, hey, create open API and create, you know, documentation on your APIs to meet these, you know, core common clinical data elements. The industry rallied and came up, I mean, the Argonaut project and wrote some guides around that. And I think subscriptions is one of those cases where I would be careful I'm not sure I would name a specific version of it right now. I would name the capability and I would name a specific topic that you wish to enable. I'll pause there because I saw hands go up in the middle before talking about scheduling.
Building a little bit further out, that looking back at having open-ended functional certification requirement and then fill it in, there that has been helpful in a number of areas to do that and make that progress. And for some, but not all, there was a collaboration to identify at least a start of a common approach, but also recognize that quite a few didn't. And the rework that needed to go into this overall from that perspective, if we look at our EHRA members as an example, that needs to be considered as well. So it's a balancing act that at this point in time, particularly if we look at subscription, where we have three alternate ways to go about it, and you do it the R4 way, the R4B way, or the R5 way, they would not necessarily lead content-wise maybe, but technically they would lead to different things. I cannot do it consistently across the board. So I think we have to be very careful with that. So the combination of it, I'd be more inclined to not go that open-ended for subscription, but more focus on ONC working with the community, A, to establish which one of the three is it. Can we work, ideally, can we work with R5 that still then is able to work with R4 content, which everything else is pretty much in? Can that work? And can we then rally around a couple of particulars to really move forward on that? And then others can start to build and snowball on top of that. So I'd be a little bit more stronger in the perspective of how ready is it, kind of, but not enough to just say, hey, let's open the floodgates by just saying subscriptions and stop there. I think that is too wide open, too much a variety that at this point in time would not be helpful.
So I'm sorry, Hans. So what specific guardrail or topic would you recommend?
There can be a couple of different topics that I think ONC and others can start to focus on and decide. But I would not say consider it for certification in the next round. Consider it as identifying with the industry what then to focus on and how to do it, and then be ready to do it. So
you're suggesting introducing the functional requirement or naming the fire spec?
I would suggest to work on defining the spec, the implementation guide that uses the subscription with the agreed to underlying format. Is it R4, R4, 5, 4B, or R5? So I would recommend that they define it with the industry, i.e. very particularly with HL7 community on what is it? What is the subset?
So basically a recommendation to continue to work on this and move toward a requirement, but with the input of industry.
Correct. So I think an open functional requirement, I think, is going to be too wide open and lead to a lot more rework than necessary. And I think between now and the next round of certification, there should be ample time to explore that and have a much more focused discussion on what that would be, as opposed to keep it open.
So I see you've actually already entered some recommendations in the spreadsheet, which is great.
Right, because I believe that we are talking realistically. We say, hey, start to look at this. That's about 2-3 years out. Now there's going to be a lot on our plate generally already with whatever is going to be subject to certification now. but 2 to 3 years time, or around that, give or take, plus or minus, is that that's a substantial amount of time to be able to start to explore, get more of experience in that space, and really truly understand what is now the real focus that we need to have. So I think we can go further than just the functional.
So, and you feel like you've captured that adequately in your recommendation in the spreadsheet?
Close, but based on today's discussion, we can refine that further.
Okay. And then you also, you know, put it in for the scheduling as well. Do you want to?
Same theme. It's essentially the same theme in that, but here it is different for scheduling, in that we have seen with this over the last couple of years, as there was interest in getting access to slots, there are two techniques that can be used. One is the one that's being proposed here. The other one is that you actually use the FHIR appointment slots and do the queries there. There are pros and cons to either one. In one approach is that you have to be very cautious that as you make slots available, by the time that somebody actually comes around, are they actually still open? And the other one is dynamically that you can maintain that so that you know it is open, but performance and volume, depending on the context, may make that challenging. So we have not seen consistently that everybody needed this and it could do it the other way and vice versa. Some needed it in order to make it work. So the question is this really something that everybody needs to support? Or is it more that you have a couple of different ways that can get the exact same information, but not necessarily this technique? That's where I would be concerned, is that at this point in time, requiring one over the other, both are valid. Directly using slots to query or making a list of slots available.
I guess my concern with that is the longer we don't settle on something, there's going to be fragmentation, right? If we continue to have alternative ways, that's not always the best approach for interoperability. So I guess my preference would be to rally around, or have everyone rally around a preferred method moving forward, rather than to have all these alternative methods continue to proliferate, which may not play well together.
The content and the resources that are in play are exactly the same. It's the technique in which you use to identify the open slots that's different. But it's the same data, it's the same format, same FHIR. That's, I think, where the challenge is in this case. It's not that you're dealing with different data expressions. It's a different way of going about finding the open slots.
So Cheryl's input, Hans, on the scheduling, I think kind of tracks with yours. Would you agree?
Yes.
Basically, more work needs to be done. We support continuing work on this, but not adding it yet to the standards, to the certification requirements.
Right. For anyone who's interested on the scheduling, this is now a few years back in the, you know, COVID scheduling craziness, like March of 21. We did do kind of an evaluation of what everybody supported from the Argonaut Scheduling IG. Background, that guide was published in 2018. One Argonaut vendor implemented all the features of it. The other Argonaut vendors implemented pieces of it, which is okay. Like it didn't go through the 8-7 standards process. It didn't go through kind of a certification piece. And so sometimes that happens. And so what that page does, it's called Scheduling Building Blocks. It summarizes kind of the capability of what kind of some of the vendors that were willing to share exactly what they did. And it is a little interesting in how there is a fair bit of variability in how the vendors share appointment types, availability, but many of them have kind of the core features core functionality to meet kind of a third-party scheduling. It is tricky because there are this idea of the kayak example comes up a lot. And in my head kind of, I don't know, and, you know, Alex, you present it, but my head always, it hurts for me to think about insurance and visit types and provider types and all kind of the special considerations that may have to go into scheduling a visit. And so I love the idea of, you know, being able to log in and search for scheduling. I think for it to be successful though, it would have to be scoped to some type of visits or some specific area to start. Because if it's just wide open, you know, enable remote third-party scheduling, I don't think that's clear enough to get to the finish line.
Completely agreed with Brett, and maybe that can be the focus of the recommendation, that there is that alignment on consistent expression of the data, what's needed, what's not, etc. And keep that somewhat distinct from the technique in which to query for slots, which is, depending on the environment, one technique is better than the other, but we want to end up looking for the same data. How do we do that? What's needed? What's minimum required, et cetera? So perhaps that's the focus for ONC to look at. Can build on the guidance that has been built in Argonaut, can focus on stepping that up to R4, further aligning it so that the building blocks with that you work with are consistent. And then the way that you, with which you can query for it, depends on the context as to which one is most appropriate and whether everybody needs to support that. And distinguish the two. Would that, Brett, also align with how you're thinking about it?
Yeah, it's funny. I think scheduling, what's hard about it, Hans, is, you know, scheduling as a concept has been around for, you know, 20 years. I mean, I talked to Steven for 5 minutes last Friday and said, hey, you know, how long has Palo Alto been doing this? And I think Steven said through the portal, over 20 years. Yeah. And so there's a part of me, Hans, that, like, I think about this one a bit, because it's like, I understand why it's through the portal works is, you know, if you've authenticated user, you know, made another insurance, you can fire these rules. But I do think, I sometimes scratch my head a bit, Hans, think about, like, how do we move this scheduling piece further forward? And, you know, sharing slots, you know, that was a good, you know, we learned a lot in the kind of the COVID vaccine piece of, you know, smart scheduling links for people to kind of publish their slots. But that didn't, you know, across the EHR community, everybody didn't adopt that because there were a lot of kind of third-party pharmacies and grocery stores and others that got in to do some of the work around that. It wasn't every EHR didn't see a need to build all that pieces out. So I'm sorry for kind of going around here. I struggle with scheduling because it's been around so long, and I, to get to the vision of, you know, Kayak or some similar type model of scheduling, it's tricky because there are so many pieces out there. It's always easier when we're building new capabilities. This is a comment I had kind of chatting with Joshua this week. It's always easier to drive adoption when we have these new capabilities rather than reworking existing mechanisms. And this is one of those cases where there's a lot of existing mechanisms and it's really hard to rework them.
I think is that if we can get to better alignment and agreement on what is needs to be part of an appointment, of a slot definition, of those different elements of it, the techniques in which you're going to access it, whether you do it dynamically, directly against the slots and query for them as needed, or whether you publish them, you are in essence still displaying the same information. So can we get agreement on that, align there, the other ones will follow as needed.
So maybe here's a crazy question to Steven, or I mean, what if you picked a specific visit type to say, you know, PT or outpatient, like there was a specific type to say, You know, taking Hans's comment about standardizing the specific data elements, but pick a visit type that doesn't have the restrictions of a specialist, but that, you know, is hard to schedule and require that as a starting point. Is that too crazy?
I mean, and could it just be a PCP visit?
Right. PCP or physical, you know, PCP, physical therapy, lab only encounter. I'm thinking of things that, like, the times I'm searching, I don't know. Those seem to me potentially, if you could define very specific visit types, because whenever I talk, there's another EHR vendor I talked to about this too, and they just said, gosh, the logic complexity we have around scheduling patients is is pretty high, but I'm like, if you could zoom into ones that don't have that, then maybe this could grow into something bigger.
I mean, I know that when we, you know, we allow patients to schedule their own visits with PCPs, right? And there's just a simple logic that says, you know, if it's more than two items, you know, you get a long visit, otherwise you get a short visit. If you're over such an age, I mean, you could bake that in. So Brett, you're saying that you think the industry, you know, could be prepared for that as a certification requirement, something really focused.
I do.
Hans, could you live with that? We don't want to put too many brakes on these things, right?
No, but I think that would be helpful to work towards that, to be clear on what would that look like, because we then need to understand for that kind of slot appointment, what's the essential information, and everybody can then aim for that in an agreed to format, FHIR or FHIR, whatever we are at that point in time. I think that would be helpful. And then again, we can snowball from there. And whether then you need to make that available in both ways, directly accessing the slots to find them, or a published set, or that you can have a choice where you do one or the other, but the client needs to support both. That can be a part of that as well, because it really then depends on the underlying source system, which one of those techniques is most suitable. And the client can support either. And that's currently, we're doing multiple support of the same information in other places as well. Case reporting, other places. It just shouldn't be anything. It should be very defined.
Right.
Or two.
I will add, so the way the Argonaut community works is every year we pitch new projects. And there's a vendor who continues to pitch the scheduling project, something they want to continue to progress. And again, the whole community did spend a year on 2018, but then, you know, other things took priorities, but there definitely, I think there still is interest in this area.
Hung, do you feel like you've captured enough of this discussion to be able to draft some recommendations?
I think so.
Great. Brad, do you have anything else to add before we try to make use of the last half hour here?
No, thank you.
Thank you so much for making the time to join us, and for, it sounds like, coming last week as well, just to sort of get up to speed on the process.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Hung, do you want to try to get us through some of your draft recommendations?
Sure. And so I guess one question I have, though, to begin with, is that I've concentrated on recommendations where we are making a specific recommendation beyond supporting the movement of the ONC. And so in the case that is on display, the task force is fully supportive of moving to US CDI version 3 as the baseline level. And so I guess my question first to Mike Berry is there, value in also drafting that as a official recommendation, or having it implied, the fact that we didn't comment on it specifically?
I'm not sure, Hung. We've not run into that before. Let me give it some thought.
I mean, we actually have, Mike. I mean, in past task force reports, I think we have kind of gone item by item and said, yes, we support this. Yes, we support this. It does take a bit more time, but it does allow participants in high tech and the public to sort of see that we thought through things line by line. I mean, I could personally go either way. You know, we'll have a slightly longer presentation if we, you know, include, you know, we support. Though it does seem
I agree, Stephen. I misunderstood the question. You're right. We have done that in the past. Just to acknowledge that the task force worked on it, as you said. I thought we were talking about, like, this one here, things that might be out of scope. You know, how would we, you know, word that? Would we just say it's out of scope and refer elsewhere?
Yeah, no, it was more the underlying item for this row three, which was the update of the standard USCDIV 3. So it sounds like you're saying, you know, yes, let's have a slide, essentially at least one slide for every row in our spreadsheet, every item we were asked to review, and have, in this case, have it say that we support the update to.
Yes, that's right. Otherwise, we would assume that you didn't address it.
But or this is like, or at least concur with the proposed. I mean, if you think about it, it's really a, hey, enthusiastic support, hey, accept, or B, hey, there's an issue and here's our suggestion.
That's good. Hans, you have your hand up.
Yeah, thank you. I have done two comments, one related to row two and one related to row three in context of this discussion. On row two, does that mean, Hung, that the sense is that that's since there is not a recommendation in column J yet, that it's intended to be a signal of general agreement and support? Or is that one to be worked on? I just want to make sure because of the other comments that were made in there.
No, that's that particular needs to be worked on.
Okay. Yeah. Just want to make sure. The main comment is on three then, where the indication is, should it be part of the annual report? Actually, this would already be very pertinent to the final rule for consideration, where already this is increasingly a concern and should already apply to the interpretation of how certification is done against USCDI version 3. So I believe that that comment cannot move to a annual report comment. It is very specifically about how USCDI version 3 relates to a G10 or a CCDA F9, whatever that one is. Very specifically to that, it's already a concern and it should not be persisted much longer. That's why I would not put it out.
Phil, you have your hand up.
Yeah, my comments are pretty closely mirrored to Hans's. I think this is already this transition from V1 to V3 is already an issue for specialty EHRs. So I was wondering if as an alternative of saying, okay, we're fully supportive of moving to V3. If we say we're supportive of moving to V3 with the condition that ONC survey the landscape of specialty EHRs and consider burden and mitigating factors to allow their participation within the full USCDI. Speaking as a specialty vendor, this USCDI is rolled into the base EHR criteria, and so it is a major issue for us to be able to comply to this.
I think by using that very specific example of EHRs, the solution to it needs to be done that it supports specialty EHRs plus other HIT that otherwise would not be able to certify against what they would like to certify against, and that they could, but they can't today. So EHR has a couple of very good examples. Other HIT of interest has also those kind of examples.
I'm not particularly comfortable with the language of condition. And so what about if we say that the task force is supportive of moving to USCDI version 3 with the recommendation that the ONC develop a simultaneous strategy, so on and so forth.
Does that satisfy, Phil? There'll be two recommendations, or one support and one recommend.
I think that that seems reasonable. I would like to, I think the last survey for specialty EHRs by ONC was something like 2012. So I would really just, so I think it's important to understand where we sit with specialty EHRs and other HIT, as you said, Hans. We just need to get a snapshot of where we're at and as part of this, but then roll in these version upgrades, roll in specialty EHRs and other HIT considerations to, and really to understand where is ONC targeting uptake of US CDI? It can't just be acute and ambulatory.
What do you think of this, Phil, this wording?
That sounds great. Yeah.
Can I make a suggestion? Is that I'd be cautious. I think resurvey would be helpful that as a tool to understand what the scenario is. But I think the emphasis should really be that ONC identifies for the upcoming certification rule how it can enable specialty EHRs and other HIT that need not support all of US CDI, that it still has the opportunity to be certified. So that there is a, I understand Hong's concern with putting the term condition in there, but we really want to make sure that every avenue is being explored and executed and acted upon, that in this next round, that that relief is already visible.
Yeah, that seems pretty prescriptive, Hans.
It is as a but it's a recommendation that they focus on that and work on enabling that.
Right, and I have trouble watering it down, just coming from an industry that has historically been overlooked with this. So I do want to make sure, as you're saying, Hans, that we get ONC's attention with this.
No, are you comfortable with the language, or what is your suggestion?
Can we work on that a little bit more so that we don't have it exactly right now, but that we are trying to find something that is not stating a condition, but can be stronger than this? Because I'm not sure whether wordsmithing right now that we can get that word. But if we say that we want to get as strong as reasonable, I understand, Steve, where you're coming from. We don't want to be too prescriptive in how they're going to do that. But there is a problem and a concern that needs to be addressed, so that it enables more EHRs, more HIT to be certified to these kind of capabilities of making the data available, particularly around G10. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's F9. I always get confused on CCDA.
Right, and I will add, there is a framework in place for ONC that they developed as part of their pediatric recommendations that targets these specialty use cases that could potentially be extended.
Okay, well, Phil and Hans, why don't you guys work on some additional language on that one, and hopefully we can revisit it next week.
Yep.
Sounds good.
You want to do the next
one? So why don't we move down to J8? Row 8. So this is the recommendation of the task force for the pharmacy interoperability request for information. So we heard from our subject matter experts that they feel strongly that version 13 is more appropriate for certification than version 12 due to the fact that there is functionality and patient demographic information that's available in version 13. That is not available in version 12. And then there's the recommendation that the ONC should require support for both NDC and RX norm because they are complementary and provide different information. And also that the both the XML and EDI formats should be continue to be supported while the developers move towards the JSON format. So rather than having an intermediary migration, we can continue support both with the final destination being the JSON format. And then lastly, to continue requiring ICD-10 with the addition of SNOMED as a complementary addition, but not a replacement for ICD-10.
Clarification question on the third. Is this meant to be that the source needs to support both XML and EDI, or that the source can use either, but as part of the intermediary, it moves into whatever other format is there? So that's the way to support the migration. If they want to support both, that's fine, but that the source is not required to support both XML and EDI.
So require support of either?
That will be fine, because then the source only needs to support one and then can migrate over however they can get there, and the intermediary can pick it up.
Yes.
Okay.
And this is Steve Eichner.
Okay.
Another modifier that we probably want to include is a opportunity for ONC to collaborate or confirm that the changes are compatible with PDMPs, prescription drug monitoring programs, and that PDMPs are suited or resourced to also support the change when it is implemented.
That's not going to be up to ONC to resource PDMPs.
No, but it's again tied to that piece that's looking at that exchange connected, that looking at non-certified technology that's impacted by these changes.
Hung, how do you want to address that?
Can we refer that to the annual report? I feel that is outside the scope.
Well, the challenge is that if ONC puts up this rule and the PDMP is not on the same page, you're going to have an incompatibility with what the certification criterion are and the entities that are receiving data that providers are required to report. So you're potentially opening a major issue.
Well, but isn't that true for all exchange? I mean, any recipient is going to see the evolving functionality of certified health IT and have a period of time to adapt to that.
Or you're assuming that there's going to be adoption to the certified criterion, and public health or other data receivers may not simply have the resources to do it and say, nope, it may be certified technology, but that's not necessary. I am not charged as a public health entity with supporting certified technology. I'm not mandated to do it. I can choose to do it. It may be economically efficient or wise for me to do it. But if I don't have the financial resources to implement the changes, I cannot do it.
No, I get it. I'm just not sure what we're recommending to whom here. I mean, recommend that public health.
The recommendation is that the alignment in changing standards be coordinated with public health and other entities to ensure that there is the opportunity for non-certified technology to receive this data.
Is that a recommendation for ONC to work with CDC?
Yes. And the stilts. Because it's not just the CDC. If your CDC doesn't mandate the standard, CDC does not dictate to stilts what data standards they use.
Okay.
for state-based transactions.
So what is the recommendation then? The ONC work with whom?
Work with CDC, and I guess you can call it CDC, CMS, and itself to ensure that sufficient resources are available in PDMPs to meet the change standard.
I struggle with that because that basically means we should add that to every single one of these then, right? Because that's going to require some investment by someone.
Well, so not necessarily for every standard. Not for every recommendation. But if you're looking at elevating or changing the version of a prescription drug standard, that information, where appropriate, is transmitted to prescription drug monitoring programs, often using the same data format. Okay. If you're changing the data format, all receivers need to be elevated to receive the same format.
Can we work together offline to craft a recommendation to that effect then?
Absolutely.
All right.
What do you think of this, Hung?
Okay. Sure. Mm.
It is, so the prescription drug monitoring programs, is this essentially a broadening of the net of certification? So we're essentially asking, are we asking these programs to participate as certified HIT, or are we saying that certified HIT must participate with these programs?
I think Ike is saying that this program receives information from certified IT, but do not have sufficient funding to ensure that they do.
PDMP programs don't use certified technology. It doesn't meet the program needs because they're not electronic health records or other technologies. So they don't benefit from HIT vendors making modifications for certified technology.
Right. And I guess the reason for my question is I'm wondering, is this just another form of specialty setting that has not adopted the certified HIT because we don't have standards and studies around?
No, it's not a specialty care area. It's a government reporting program, or actually it's included in promoting interoperability requirements. So this is another element where, like for ECR, there are requirements on certified technology to meet standards. And elevating to those standards is in certification requirements. There are no certification requirements currently in place for public health systems or other systems that are receiving this type of data, nor are there resources necessarily available to modify those systems to current standards or future standards.
Hey, we need to cut to public comment and then we can pick this up.
Okay, we're going to open up our meeting for public comment. If you're on Zoom and like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're on the phone only, press *9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. So I see Mark Savage has his hand up. Mark, you have 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mike. Just being available to respond to the question that was asked in the middle of the meeting. As I recall, when I put the comment in about the fast shared care planning use case and the applicability of the subscription approach, I think it was Phil that asked more generally about fast use cases and whether they were applicable here. And I was on the ecosystem use case Tiger team. I led the shared care planning use case. To my recollection, none of the other use cases contained a subscription function within them. That doesn't mean that a subscription function wouldn't be useful to them, but I don't think they were designed at that time. However, the shared care planning use case did do that. We were struggling with the question, what's the single point of truth, sort of version control for a dynamic longitudinal shared care plan? Recognize that not all members of a care team would want access to everything in real time. And so we recommended a subscription approach, thinking that the main doctor, which is not necessarily a primary care physician, but the main doctor would be the single point of truth, and one could subscribe to updates based on individual preferences. So that's my best attempt to answer the general question and provide a little more context on the specific example.
And Mark, thank you for that. This is Phil. I'm wondering, so what were the deliverables of that specific work group? Did you have specific an IG that was delivered for that, or were there specific standards referenced?
We put out use cases, and I put the link to the shared care planning use case in the chat, and it was then for other these were meant to guide the other Tiger teams who were working on details of things, and I was not on those other Tiger teams. Don't know yet what they have done with that. And since then, FAST is transferred over to HL7, so there may be some further work in different directions that's happening. So it was basically the document that sort of the blueprint, if you will, specifying needs and approaches that the ecosystem use case Tiger team did as a starting point.
Okay. So maybe to Hans's point, this is a potential use case that may be a good starting area to look at as these standards evolve.
Agreed. It would make an immense contribution.
and that's for subscriptions, right, Mark?
Yes.
Yeah. No, that I love that. Okay. Well, Hung is going to craft a nice recommendation from all of us for us to consider next week. Do we have any other public comment, Mark? Mike?
Not seeing any other public comments, so we can go back to previous discussions.
It'd be nice if we could get through this item on row 8 here. To be clear, I think that, like adding in the specific reference to a specific recipient of PDMP data saying you need to keep up with the standards, is pretty focused. I think as Phil was getting at, there's lots of folks who don't use certified technology that are going to be the recipients of data from systems that do use certified technology. And, and the world will keep turning.
Well, it's not directing, I'm not envisioning a recommendation saying directing PDMP systems to upgrade, but again, the PDMP program is supported, but is a government program. It's supported by promoting interoperability, and there is the potential for a missed alignment between the certified program here and looking at the ability for providers to meet promoting interoperability requirements in the sense of not being able to maintain an interface with PDMP systems with the current technology. And that puts providers in an awkward position of not being able to upgrade their technology if PDMP reporting is required.
So how do you feel about the wording of the recommendation as it is?
I think we can tweak it just a little bit offline.
Okay. That, and the last one that Hung crafted regarding ICD-10 as the primary diagnosis code set, with SNOMED CT as a complementary addition. Any concerns about that? All right.
Is there any need to say as updated or as maintained, or is that inherent?
Yeah, I like it too.
You said you like this, Clem?
Yeah. The last one, and we're talking about ICD-10.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the days ICD-11 is going to creep in, but I don't think it's relevant yet.
No, not yet. Okay. So, Ike, you want to make some further suggestion, I think, on this piece here in red, or soon to be in red. But other than that, I think we've had our way with this cell. Do you want to try to do something in the last 3 minutes, Hung, or should we hang it up for now?
We actually have, I think we can do perhaps four.
Yes.
Yes.
Four would be good. The task force is supportive of the recommended adoption of CCDA companion guide R4. Going once, going twice.
Well, just clarify where the different levels of R are. I thought that some of them were skipping to R6. Does anybody know the details on that?
Yes, it's this one is, if you really want to get the full name, is HL7 CDA 2.0 CCDA 2.1 Companion Guide R4 for the CCDA document. And Brett can correct me if I'm wrong. He's way deeper into it than I am. The R6 is in the context of fire, where there is talk about after fire R4, where do we go? That's where R6 comes in play.
Okay, thank you.
This one is R4, the companion guide.
So did I get that, Hans? I don't think I got every word.
Yeah, no, that I think that's fine. Brett, are you comfortable with that? Because you're one of the key owners of that area, I think, still.
Yeah, I can paste the title in here in a moment.
Here. Okay.
Yeah, that's the real official one. Mouthful. Wow.
Okay. All right. Well, that brings us to the top of the hour.
And we got one done.
No, I think we got, did we get two? No, you're right. Just one. Yeah. Okay. I can't copy from chat. So don't turn us off yet, guys, so I can retype that. Thank you, Mark. Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Hung. We have lots of work to do still to get all of these finalized next week. Please, everyone, pay attention. Keep an eye on the spreadsheet, see how they're evolving, and come with very specific recommendations for how to improve them. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.